realize I was eating old El Paso. Hef built his empire on the finer things in life. He had a half dozen or so staff cook all his meals in a million-dollar kitchen, and there we were, eating a store-bought taco kit with iceberg lettuce and pre-grated cheddar. To go along with everything else in that house, this was, hands down, the saddest lunch I'd ever seen. Don't get me wrong, I'm not above a taco kit. Nobody should be, because they're delicious. But this was the Playboy Mansion, for God's sake. I wanted to appear appreciative and impressed, though, so I looked at Hef and said, "Man, these are just like the ones we have back home." Hef smiled and grunted, but said no actual words, while one of his guys chimed in with, "Yep, this is the chef's special. Hef knows what he likes," which tells you just about everything you ever need to know about that place. I've told this story 100 times over the years, but I always add more boobs. I never talked to Lexi again, but years later, I looked her up. I couldn't find anything about her or the company she said she ran, but I did read a story about a woman with her exact same name who looked exactly like her who got popped for fraud and identity theft in Florida. Probably wasn't her. Learn to dance. We often choose isolation rather than risk embarrassment. That's just what we do, especially young men. That's why we rarely dance. Dancing is the single greatest example of just that. We'd rather sit alone at a table at a wedding or stand against a wall at a junior high after school dance. We'll watch our girlfriend out there by herself or with some other guy rather than run the risk of being laughed at, being made a fool of. We're terrified of being embarrassed. We say things like, "Not now, maybe the next one," or "Can we wait for a slow song?" Isolation over embarrassment. Being alone always felt better than being singled out. Of course, this is totally irrational. Really, it's a fear of something else. It's not a fear of dancing, but a fear of being vulnerable. We don't teach kids the value of vulnerability, especially young men. Nobody ever tells you that without vulnerability, there's no intimacy. And without intimacy, what are we? What the hell are we even doing? My old man danced. Long before Meredith and Christina danced it out on Grey's Anatomy, my pops danced it out on any floor that felt good enough under his slippers. Even when there was no music playing, he was still a fantastic, fun dancer. You'd never see him smile so hard as you would when he was whipping and spinning my mom around the kitchen on a Sunday morning. I don't know who taught him or where he learned, but after everything he had been through, all the trauma, abuse, and war, my old man was two things. He was hard to kill, and he was a great dancer. There are levels to this, to life, and my dad reached levels of vulnerability and intimacy that I didn't fully see or understand until years after he was dead. When I was working that job, I danced. Every night, in rock bars or gay bars, it didn't matter. I never danced to fit in or to feel like I was part of something. I danced to get lost, alone, drenched and drunk, eyes closed, head down, surrounded by a few hundred strangers. That was where I felt most comfortable. You have to find something in your day that makes it all worthwhile. Otherwise, what the fuck did you just do? Complaining about your life to other miserable people does not count. Being angry all the time is exhausting, and I was always exhausted. I drowned the parts that hurt and burned the parts that didn't. I felt so goddamn heavy, always. I looked for comfort and validation in anything and anyone that cared just enough to make sure I got home okay, but not much else. I was incapable of self-improvement, was tired from keeping secrets, and most days I was obsessively focused on finding the next exit sign. A temporary escape, a way out. That's what dancing was for me. It was the thing that made it all worth it. So I danced. I danced my ass off. Skin-tight black jeans, eyeliner, a wallet chain, 3-buckle skull boots with a short heel and a white undershirt. That was my uniform, even in the winter. I never left the apartment in a coat because I never wanted to deal with or pay for coat check. So I hustled or paid off the doorman when I arrived to avoid freezing in line. Once a week, I walked over to the mall up the street and spent $16 on a brand new 6-pack of jockey ribbed white tank tops. I never wore the same one twice. I always thought of these as disposable. Most clubs had a dress code that at least required a shirt of some kind. But once through the doors, I grabbed a double vodka soda with a splash of cranberry from the bar, lit a cigarette, took off my shirt, tucked it into my back pocket, and made my way to the middle of the dance floor. I was like Jeff Spicoli walking into All-American Burger in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Every now and then, while standing at the bar, a bouncer walked up to say something like, "Hey man, I know you had a shirt on when you came in here." But the shirts were always long gone by that point, lost, thrown, or used to stop the bleeding from some new cut on my arm from getting bumped too hard, hitting the dance floor, and landing on broken glass. I never got home looking like I had a fun night out with friends. I always looked like I had just come from Fight Club. I have lots of holes in my memory, blank spaces, missing detail, and lost time. Over the years, I've gotten used to it. I'm always the guy who unknowingly and unapologetically reintroduces himself to a person I've met 4 times before, but every time is like the first time for me. There are certain things I keep and certain things I don't. I've spent hundreds of hours lost in the middle of a dance floor. I remember the feeling, but never the night. It was one of those nights when I met Summer, and the night I met Summer was the last night I went dancing. I don't remember who said what first or how we started talking, but we connected immediately. I think maybe we did a shot and arm wrestled. Totally normal stuff. She wasn't wearing her regular clothes, though. I remember that much. These were club clothes, the type of late 90s gear we cringe at today. But she looked beautiful. She had blonde hair, dark freckles, and stunning eyes that darted back and forth as she tried to figure me out. I don't know what she thought I was, but I assume she thought I was all dressed up too, that this was all for show, a costume. Summer was an actor. I'd never met an actor before, and she had all the charm and confidence that only performers have. She was magnetic, and I couldn't take my eyes off her. She was also the first woman I ever met who ever called me smart. And from that first meeting, the two of us in the back of that dark club, we were instantly boyfriend-girlfriend. There was no first date or feeling each other out. She looked at me like nobody ever had before. I'm sure she saw some things in me that didn't actually exist, but that didn't matter. I made it work. I quickly became the thing that she thought I was. I reinvented myself. I liked the way she made me feel, and nothing else mattered after that. Summer was my first actual grown-up girlfriend after years of one-night stands and bar hookups. I stopped smoking, quit dyeing my hair black, and didn't wear eyeliner anymore. I started dressing differently too. All her friends, her entire crew, were actors as well. They all had incredible style that I tried to copy. I really didn't have any good friends of my own. Summers welcomed me with open arms, and I felt I was finally part of something. We were officially a couple, a great couple, and we spent every day together. Birthday parties, friends' weddings. We did all the coupley things that I hadn't done since high school. We spent the holidays with her parents for a few days, where I headed out to the garage with her dad to drink scotch, smoke cigars, and bond. Her parents were wonderful people who really did seem to love me. My parents adored the shit out of Summer, too. There's a difference between pretending to be someone else and trying to become a whole new person. That's where things started to fall apart for me. Summer and I had this incredible relationship, but the deeper we went, the harder it was for me to not fall apart. I liked the way things were in the beginning, but the longer it went on, the harder it was to avoid certain issues. I never really opened up properly or let Summer see any of the things I had stacked away. I wasn't ready to talk about the way I really felt about myself, not out loud. Even if I'd tried, I wouldn't have known where to start or how to get the words out. So I started looking for a way out. I knew things had to end. I knew one way or another I was going to fuck this beautiful, fun, adult relationship up. I had a choice: be vulnerable and embrace intimacy, or run, burn it all down. I could have been honest with her, but I wasn't. I could have told her how afraid I was, but I didn't. So I married one of her friends instead. The wedding. Until my late 20s, the only person I ever really hurt was myself, and I was good at it. Up to that point, I didn't know what it felt like to hurt someone else, to truly let someone down. I'd never lived with the regret and guilt that comes with being a shit person. Summer and I had been together well over 2 years when she got an incredible offer to join the cast of a musical that was touring across the country. She was, and still is, one of the best singers I've ever heard with my own ears, and I encouraged her to go. I begged her. She was so excited. "Do it," I told her. "You have to do this. You'll crush it." This was a once-in-a-lifetime type opportunity for her, and she'd be gone for months. I was truly happy for her. She'd worked so hard for every single gain she made in that business. She fought for every inch. But I couldn't help but look at the trip as a way to pump the brakes, give me a bit of room to think, a way for me to catch my breath. I did none of that. I never do well on my own. I need accountability. I know that about myself. It's one of the reasons I've lived with my brother my whole life. Sure, I love him, and I know I'd be crushed and miss him every single day if we moved away from each other. But also, having him around always makes me accountable. My brother being in our condo meant I had to get up and go to work every day, especially on the days when I had zero fight left in me. It forced me to eat and shower regularly and to be social. I needed to show up sober and alive every now and then. I needed, and still need, someone to come home to every day who's going to love me no matter what. I needed that sense of accountability in my relationships too, although I didn't know it at the time. When Summer left, I lost all accountability and myself. The guy I was, the one who kissed her goodbye at the airport when she left, was gone as soon as I jumped into a cab to head back into the city. It was instantaneous. Taylor was the younger sister of one of Summer's best friends, and we all hung out together. Those few months when Summer was away were a blur. If I wasn't at work, I was in a bar alone. And when I wasn't in a bar alone, I was in a bar with Taylor. That's when I fell in love again, over endless pitchers of beer, bar games, stories, reckless fun, pints of Long Island iced tea, and ashtrays overflowing with cigarette butts. Taylor was different. She wasn't like any friend I'd ever had. She wasn't wired like anyone else I'd met. She was the first person I knew who actually grew up in the city when everyone else seemed to come to Toronto from somewhere else. She lived by a different code and a whole set of rules I didn't know existed. She believed in things I'd never paid any attention to and saw the world in a completely different way. Her views on politics and social justice before that was even a thing, and what it meant to be a good person, your own person, all came from a place I hadn't been exposed to. Taylor was so fiercely independent that I don't think she'd ever had a real boyfriend before. She was so sure of herself that it changed my outlook on just about everything. Nothing else mattered when I was with Taylor. I loved who I became when I was with her. In all of it, though, in all this stuff about Taylor that took so much time to wrap my head around, there was one thing I knew for sure. Taylor was never going to get married. She didn't need anyone, and certainly not a husband. That wasn't her plan. The day Summer flew home from her acting gig, I met her at the airport at 9 in the morning, smelling like vodka and looking like shit. I'd woken up at 5 a.m., still drunk from the night before. When she walked through those double doors with all her luggage, what she saw was not the guy she'd left a few months earlier. She didn't get what she deserved. She didn't get the boy who said he loved her, the one who she went on vacations with, who spent the holidays with, the one who told her to follow her dreams because he'd be right here when she got home. What she got instead was an even shittier version of the person she'd met in that club that first night. At the airport, I was stumbling around wearing a long fake fur coat and jeans I hadn't washed in a month, and I hadn't showered in I don't know how long. I barely acknowledged her. I was so ashamed, and my head was pounding from guilt and from whatever I did the night before, which I had zero memory of. There were no smiles, hugs, or welcome home flowers. I was rude and distant. I ignored her castmates, and I couldn't get out of there fast enough. I was fucking cruel and embarrassing. I dropped her off in a cab at her house so she could unpack, then I continued home. We planned to meet back up at my place later that afternoon. When you dump somebody, when it's truly time to end things, you need to be blunt yet compassionate. You need to offer closure and leave no option for reconciliation if there isn't one. If it's truly over, you need to say that, as hard as it may be. People are owed that. You owe it to them to be honest and end things in a way that allows them to take the time to process and heal. It needs to be a clean break. That's what Summer deserved, but I did none of that. I offered up every bad excuse and line a guy can chef up to avoid telling the truth. I need space. I don't know if I'm ready for this. It's all so hard. How can I love someone else when I don't even love myself? I'm unlovable. I ran the table on bullshit excuses that afternoon, all of which were to avoid saying the one thing I actually needed to say, what Summer needed to hear, the truth. I don't love you anymore. The only thing I remember Summer saying to me was, I don't understand. What's happening? Why? What happened? She left my place confused and incredibly hurt, and I let her walk out thinking there was still a chance, that I just needed to work on a few things. Of course, there was no chance of any of that happening. A couple months later, I married Taylor, and Summer found out through gossip. Taylor and I were engaged for less than a month. The whole thing happened so fast. Don't get me wrong, it was all crazy romantic, punk rock, and came from a place of love that I'd never experienced before. We were alone in my room after another night out, lying side by side on my bed while I had one leg hanging off the edge. That somehow helped with the room spins and helped me make sure I didn't throw up. Taylor and I were messy, and we were in love. You have to make me a promise, I said. If this, all of this, ever becomes too much and you want to bail, you have to give me time to clean myself up before you walk away. Give me time to get my shit together, fix things. Promise me that. I don't have to, she answered. I'll never get sick of this. I'm never leaving. Not you, not ever. I rolled off the bed, landed on my knees, and started rifling through my nightstand, looking for a pen and paper. Write that down. Everything you just said, and sign it. We'll both sign it. And that's what we did. We made up a contract and both signed it. So, what does this mean? I asked. It means it's forever, she said. Yeah, but what do we do with that? If you're never going to leave me, and I'm never going to leave you, what do? Do we get married now? She smiled at me. I felt the world speed up around us. Everything made sense. Yes, that's exactly what we do, she said. And that's exactly what we did. I went rooting through my jewelry box, which was a shoebox wrapped in yellow duct tape, and found a ring that fit her. It was nothing special, but she loved it, and didn't flinch when I told her that I'd found it years earlier in an ashtray out front of a dry cleaner. There's still a huge part of me that believes this was a game of chicken that neither one of us was willing to call. We were holding hands about to drive off a cliff, both refusing to hit the brakes. It was like when you commit to doing something even though you can predict your inevitable failure, but you still follow through because you made a promise. There was no long-term plan. We had nothing. We hadn't had one single conversation about the future or how any of this would work. But we were committed. The plan was to do it all alone, but Taylor wound up telling her sister, which meant I had to tell my brother. And so there we were, six people at our wedding. The two of us, my brother, his girlfriend, Taylor's sister, and the British former fighter pilot who married us. Taylor wore a baby blue Betsy Johnson dress and knee-high black combat boots, and I wore a shiny black sharkskin suit and eyeliner. I catered the whole thing. And as long as it took to get a marriage license and find someone to come to the house and marry us on my rooftop, we were married. I'd never felt more special. A woman who'd lived her whole life convinced she'd never get married, who didn't need any of that, had just married me. The year before Taylor and I got married, Rich convinced me to empty whatever savings I had, sell what I could, and pool my money with his so we could afford the down payment on a new townhouse not far from where he worked. The neighborhood was terrible, but developers were buying up all the land, and if we got in early, we could be set. We could flip it in a couple of years and buy something even bigger. My brother's girlfriend, Leanna, started living with us not long after we got the place, so Taylor moved in with the three of us. We waited a week or two, then we told our parents. None of this went over well with Taylor's mom and dad. They only knew me as Summer's boyfriend, who showed up as her date a few times over the holidays when Taylor's mom hosted brunches for her and her sister's friends. Her father, who I really wanted to like me, was even less impressed than her mom. It's not that they didn't know me or because Taylor was younger than I was. They were just worried. They were asking all the questions we should have asked ourselves, but didn't. Everything was real now. My parents, on the other hand, were ecstatic. The first time they met Taylor, they met her as my wife. We drove back to Acton, walked through the door, and just blurted it out. There were about 30 seconds of shock and confusion. Then my dad got up out of his chair, danced over to us, dropped to the ground, and wrapped his arms around Taylor's ankles. He immediately started begging for grandchildren. My dad wanted to be a grandfather more than just about anything, and he'd started buying presents for our kids when my brother and I were still kids. When I was about 5 and Rich was around 8, my pop got us matching low-rider bikes called Green Machines. They were sort of like a big wheel, but infinitely cooler, and we lived on those things. We had only had them about a week before my dad went back to the same department store in Montreal and picked up a third, but that Green Machine wasn't for us. That Green Machine was for his future grandchild. He knew that handing that over to one of our kids would make him the coolest grandfather ever. Every kid should have one of these, he told us. My dad kept that thing in the same box for over 20 years and only got rid of it when he and my mom moved into a place without a garage and they needed the space. I know that broke his heart a little. Please, please, grandchildren, grandchildren now, my pop howled, lying face down on the floor, half fake crying, while still hanging on to Taylor's legs with both arms and his whole heart. Kids, that was another thing Taylor and I had never talked about before we got married. Not one conversation, but my old man was happy, so we let him have that moment. My parents welcomed her into the family and told me that they expected this would happen one day. My mom had long come to terms with the fact that she would most likely not be at my wedding. She knew this was coming. She knew if it ever did happen, it would happen exactly like this. They were just happy to see me happy. Taylor moved out of the townhouse for the first time 3 months later. It was about a month and a half before Christmas, and I was sitting at work doing what I normally did, pretending everything in my life was fine. Nobody had any idea Taylor had left. Most of the people I work with didn't even know I was married, and I had zero desire to sit and try to explain the whole thing to anyone. I was crushed and felt like a loser. I wasn't even sure at this point that I actually wanted to be married, but I sure as fuck didn't want to feel like a failure in front of my boss or anyone else. It was just after lunch when my mom called my office phone, which was super unusual. She never called me at work. I hadn't told her that Taylor had left, that she was overwhelmed and needed space, so as soon as I heard my mom's voice, I put on a giant smile so I at least sounded happy. "Hey, Ma, what's up?" I said like I didn't have a care in the world. "Dad's in the hospital again. We met with the doctors today." I knew my dad had been sick and dealing with pneumonia, but he'd had it before tons of times, so during these last few weeks, I hadn't thought too much about it. I hadn't talked to him in a while and just assumed, well, nothing. I was so consumed with what was happening with me and Taylor, I hadn't even bothered to check in. "Your dad has cancer," my mom told me. At this point, she tried her best to keep it together and to be strong for me, sticking to the facts and remaining positive and optimistic. As she held in tears on her end, I did my best to hold it together on mine. I was in an office full of people, people who, up to this point, had never seen anything that even resembled an emotion from my corner of the room. I remember my hands going numb and my back getting hot. I fought back tears so hard I thought my throat was going to close. I knew if I blinked or even closed my eyes just once, there would be no stopping the flood. So I stared down at my notebook on my desk and I wrote the word no over and over again. My mom kept talking, but I'd stopped listening long ago. I didn't need to hear anything else. I had no questions. "Yeah, okay, bye now," I said in the happiest tone I could pull together. Then I hung up the phone. I sat for a few more minutes as people buzzed in and out around me. Slowly, I put on my coat and walked out. I took the same two buses, subway, and streetcar home. I sat in the same seat I always did. I did what I always did. Nothing. When I got home, Rich was already there, standing at the top of the stairs as I opened the front door. I kicked off my boots, dropped my bag, and walked up. The only thing Rich said to me was, "Hey, brother." Then nothing, not a word. I kept my head down because I knew if we made eye contact, I'd start to cry. The baseboards needed to be repainted, the railing resanded, and the carpet hadn't been vacuumed in months. It was beige, but they called it Spice Peach when we bought the place. I used everything around me as a distraction. I could tell Rich had had the exact same afternoon I did. I knew he hadn't told anyone either. Neither of us had said the words out loud. Then he hugged me. As we stood there in the small hallway hugging, we both broke down. I didn't know much, but I was sure that from this point on, nothing was ever going to be the same again. In that moment, hugging and crying seemed better than sitting and talking, so that's all we did. We just stood there, together, quietly sharing the second worst day of our lives. That is why I always need to come home to someone who's going to love me no matter what. About a week later, the TV network canceled the show I was working on. I got fired. Dad's official diagnosis was mesothelioma. He'd spent his entire career calibrating the instruments that they used to build jet engines for airplanes. He was good at it, but his job was never his life. It was never his identity. He was always so much more than just what he did. He had worked for the same company for 25 years in the same room with the same gear. The room he worked in was attached to what they called a test cell, where they ran these huge engines alone for hundreds of hours before putting them on a plane. Every precaution was taken to keep my dad and everyone else safe. These were jet engines, full of jet fuel, and this was the room that would determine whether they would explode or not. The walls, ceiling, and floor were lined with asbestos, and my dad worked in that room for most of his adult life. The place he woke up for at 5 in the morning every day, the place he worked so many night shifts and so much overtime to make sure we always had the best Christmases, was the place that killed him. His job killed him. My dad retired from that company early, a year before he found out his body was full of cancer. He was on his time now. My dad had cancer, my marriage was ending, and I just lost my job. I didn't ask any questions that I didn't want to know the answer to, so I didn't look anything up about the kind of cancer he had. I did zero research. But every now and then, when I did start telling friends what he had, the reactions were always the same. If people didn't know what it was, I'd have to try my best to explain. If they did, if they knew more than me, they'd just hug me and say nothing. If you knew, you knew, I guess. I wanted to run or rewind time. I just wanted out, but I had nowhere to turn. I couldn't talk to Taylor. My brother was going through all the same shit I was, and my mom had it worst of all. I'd never felt so alone. I had all these people in my life, and I had never felt so alone. So I called Summer. Summer had heard about my dad through friends and agreed to meet me for coffee. I was desperate and just wanted things to go back to normal. "I need you," I said. "I can't go through this alone. I don't know what to do. Just please help me." "Roz, your dad is dying," she said. "He's going to die." Summer was the first person to ever say those words to me. She was the one who made it real. And as messed up as this sounds, I appreciated it and thanked her. Summer did what, up to this point, nobody else had. She was blunt yet compassionate. She was all the things I wasn't. She gave me what I should have given her on that day I broke her heart. She gave me the truth. 3. All dads die. That one time in therapy. It was 3 weeks before Christmas, and I knew this was going to be my dad's last one. His favorite day of the year. And he only had one left. I was so lost, I didn't know if I was going to make it to the weekend, let alone the holidays. I was never good at asking for help, Not because I never felt I needed it or could use it, but I always felt it ended with me in debt to someone. My goal was to always end my day without feeling I owed anything to anyone. Every day needed a clean ending. That was the only way I could sleep. I was relentlessly independent, cripplingly private, and I didn't even know where to start when it came to finally asking for help. I've always been susceptible to influence, so I avoided any situation, like therapy, where someone could put something weird or fucked up in my head that wasn't there before. I'm obsessive like that. When I was a kid, my mom casually told me that she could never go to Niagara Falls because she always got the urge to jump. That's exactly how she said it too, like it was no big deal. She couldn't really explain it. She wasn't suicidal, but she was just drawn to the fall, to that quiet moment of nothing on the way down, to the freedom. Before my mom confessed that to me, I'd never thought about jumping off anything. But ever since, I've avoided the edge of everything. Even today, I always request low floors in hotels that have balconies. I'll never take that last step to look over anything, no matter how beautiful the view is. Her thing became my thing. That's why I was afraid of therapy. I didn't want someone putting something in my head that I'd never be able to remove. I didn't want anyone messing with the stuff that I'd meticulously filed away. I was afraid that if someone started pulling it apart, I'd never be able to get it back together again. I was convinced that my feelings were far too complex and unique for anyone to understand, no matter how many diplomas they had on the wall. I knew as soon as I started talking, saying shit out loud, then everything would become real, and there was no coming back from that. I once heard someone say that articulating your feelings is the first step to accepting them. I wasn't ready to accept anything. Therapy wasn't my last option, but it sure as hell felt like it. I didn't need a hero, but I did need help, and I was finally ready to ask for it. I called up a psychiatrist I'd booked as a guest on the show over the years. We knew each other, and he was great at what he did. In my head, therapy was a luxury that people who grew up where I did didn't have. I'd never met anyone who had a therapist. This was some bougie and expensive shit that I didn't know how to do. How do you do therapy? How honest do you have to be to make it work? My appointment was set up as a one-off. My therapist was unbelievably casual about the whole thing, too. I explained a bit over the phone when I first reached out, but I didn't get too deep as I didn't want to overload him. I didn't want him to know how fucked up I actually was. I didn't want to burden him with my problems, which I knew was sort of the point, but I didn't want to owe him. I blamed myself for everything, and in a messed up way, I needed him to tell me it was all my fault, that I needed to take responsibility. That was my plan. Shrink sessions are usually 45 minutes. I figure this is to give them enough time to run patients in and out in one-hour blocks. I was his 11 a.m. that day. Getting to his Midtown office took about an hour, one streetcar, a few subway stops, and a long bus ride. I made a CD the night before with Sit Down by James after 1991 reissue of Gold Mother burned over and over again. I listened to that track on repeat for the entire trip while I rehearsed what I would and wouldn't say. I prioritized what I felt I needed help with the most and looked for ways to dumb down or totally avoid all the rest. This was a one-time deal. I had one shot. What I didn't know then is that therapy is hard as fuck, but it's supposed to be. If you find it easy, find a new doctor. I sat on that couch in the psychiatrist's eclectic but messy office and told him what I thought he wanted to hear. I never wanted to burden anyone, and I hated being fussed over, so I skimmed over my feelings of failure and my own self-worth. I was the farthest thing from an open book, and even sitting there distracted by all his important junk piled everywhere, I still wasn't ready to say most things out loud. I opened myself up a bit and let him take a look. This is where, for me, it all went to hell. This is where I started looking for a way out. I wanted to stay in the moment, to fix the things that hurt now. I didn't want to look back and map out every single event that got me to his couch that morning. I didn't want to be judged because I was afraid that I'd disappoint him. It felt like an audition, like I needed to say all the right things to keep him interested, to prove I wasn't wasting his time. I needed to come off as therapy worthy, but not too big of a project. I quickly explained what was killing my dad as best I could, and I touched on the guilt I had over Taylor leaving. I told him I believed the world was full of monsters, and I was incapable of seeing the good in anyone. I explained I was convinced that everyone I'd ever met was an opportunistic phony who would fuck me over in a heartbeat to gain even 1 inch in life. Yeah, you might not be wrong, he said with a cool casualness that confused the hell out of me. I sounded paranoid and all over the place. I'd never talked about any of this before, and I didn't really know how to. I was performing for him, treating him like an audience. Even the stuff that hurt the most, I tried to say in a way that would make him laugh. Tell me about your mom, he said. Good cook, believes in ghosts, taught me how to sew. I wasn't dragging my mother into this. She was about to lose the love of her life and was hanging on by her teeth. What about your brother? He's smart, funny, a nerd, but like a cool nerd. I was doing a routine. I'd really only ever bonded with people over two things, sex and humor. I knew enough about myself to know these were a defense mechanism. That was my escape. The doctor didn't even flinch. While I told him most of what I was willing to say, he barely moved his pen across the pad propped up on his knee. At first, I thought I was failing, wasting his time. What I quickly realized was there was nothing I was saying that he hadn't heard 100 times before. None of this was unusual, and this guy had me figured out top to bottom in the first 30 minutes, which infuriated me. The only thing worse than someone thinking you're fucked up is someone telling you you're normal. This was actually all good news, and I should have been relieved, but screw that guy. I sat there in pieces as he mapped out a way to put me back together. By the end of our session, the one-off, the favor for a friend, he told me he wanted to see me again the following Tuesday and Thursday, then the next Tuesday and Thursday for the foreseeable future. He knew I was holding back. In 45 minutes, I'd gone from having never done this kind of thing before to being a twice-a-week shrink patient. I was pissed. Realizing there's a path to success isn't the same as following that path. I wasn't ready to do the work to get where I wanted to be. I had told him maybe 1/10 of what I should have, and I was already a career patient. That was my last appointment. I'm pretty good at giving advice, but absolute shit at taking it, although I do try to learn from my mistakes, my biggest being that I judged my individuality, that thing that separated me from everyone else, by how much hell I could go through and still carry on. I judge myself on how much pain I could mask from my friends, family, and coworkers, and never ask for help. I chose to hide my scars, self-destruction, self-sabotage, tics, loss, abuse, and failure, and managed to never let it show. By opening up just a little in therapy, I let the light in, and it burned like bloody murder. I didn't know then that individuality, that thing that actually makes us special, doesn't come from how much we can handle. It comes from what we can offer. I had so much work to do, but instead of getting on with it, I walked away and torched the path behind me. I wasn't ready to put every thought I had on trial or attach meaning to things I'd spent years trying to forget. I got back on that bus and managed to get the same seat I always did. I reached into my bag, pulled out my notebook, and flipped to the page with my dad's Christmas list on it. He had one Christmas left, and I hadn't even started shopping yet. A Christmas Story. My dad had this beautiful way of always fucking up Christmas morning. We were Christmas people. There was no Secret Santa single gift exchange, and we never got too old or bored of seeing a tree exploding with presents on Christmas morning. Even when Rich and I were grown up and had long since moved out, my family didn't set budgets or come up with restrictive rules. We just bloody went for it. All of us, every single year. My old man was the undisputed king of Christmas, and he'd always spend way more than he had to make sure we got everything we asked for, and a ton of stuff we didn't. My mom did the vast majority of the Christmas planning, prepping, cooking, and shopping. She still tells us stories from when we were kids of her coming home with bags and bags of gifts for us. And my dad would look at her and always say the same thing. That's not enough. We'll go back out tomorrow. Together, we can carry more. When it came to my pops and Christmas, everything was never enough. When Rich and I started making our own money, big money, was when things really went bonkers. The weeks leading up to the holidays became a frantic but well-oiled, glorious pain in the ass. Each of us would write up and pass out a list of everything we wanted. Then everyone else would sneak off and talk privately to divvy it up. Rich would always figure out who was getting what for who. He was, by far, the most organized. My mom's list was, without question, the most important, though. She did all the work, so she got the most attention. She got everything she wanted. My mom's list was the one thing we couldn't fuck up. But every year, my dad would. Even as adults, long after we had moved out, my brother was still the master of the lists, and he took that job seriously. He'd write down everything mom asked for, divvy it up, and assign things to me and my dad to get. He'd break it down by price, priority, and store location to make sure she was fully taken care of. We all knew what we were in charge of getting. We'd spend that last week checking in with each other to make sure nobody forgot anything. Of course, my mom couldn't have cared less about what she got as long as we were all home and together, but making her feel like a kid on Christmas morning was always our way to thank her for being such a great mom. And then my dad made a mess of the entire thing. Aside from the giftsplosion we'd wake up to every year, we didn't really have too many big family traditions, but we did have a million little ones. Anne Murray or Boney M. would always be playing as my mom walked out of the kitchen with a fresh pot of coffee and a bottle of Bailey's. She'd set out a tray of sausage rolls straight from the oven and a huge bowl of those little round potatoes from a can that she'd fried up in a pan with hot oil and herbs. There was always leftover tortillere from Christmas Eve and enough chips and chocolate to keep us awake and full until dinner. We've eaten the same thing every Christmas morning for our entire lives. For years, my mom had suggested maybe one time we could all wake up, shower, and get dressed and have a nice breakfast in the dining room before opening gifts. That was never going to happen. We were not those people. Between me, Rich, and Dad, if even one of us managed to get dressed for dinner, it was seen as a Christmas miracle. A few weeks before the holidays, my dad went in for laparoscopic surgery. They explained that they wanted to go in with tiny cameras to get a better look at the tumors. Just a few small holes, no big deal. The day he went in, he was ready. My dad had a process that he went through before any of his appointments with doctors or surgeons. He did this alone. We'd do one last group hug, then he'd tell us that he had to get ready. I'm not sure what he thought about or said to himself in those moments, but whatever it was, it always got him out the other side. No matter what the doctors did, Dad always woke up ready for whatever was coming next. I went to see him in the hospital the day after the surgery, and he was sitting up at the end of the bed when I walked in. Even up to this point, I'd never actually seen my dad lying in a hospital bed. He was always propped right up or sitting off the side. It was clear he did this for me. "Want to see what they did to me?" he asked as he slid his gown off one arm. "They cut me in half." He pulled down the other shoulder, and I didn't even know what I was looking at. There was a slice so big, I couldn't tell where it started or where it ended. He had bandages covered in dried blood with exposed staples sticking out of the sides from the center of his chest, down in a half circle to his hip, then up his back to between his shoulders, a giant U-shape. Yeah, they cut him in half. That wasn't supposed to happen. These were supposed to be tiny holes for tiny cameras, but the doctor said they needed a better look. They did all of this without telling us or even asking, and there was no coming back from it. There was no way my dad would be strong enough to enjoy Christmas. I don't know how he managed to get himself to the end of the bed or why he felt like he had to, but he wasn't the same man he'd been 2 days before. He was about to go through as much chemo and radiation as one human being is supposed to be able to handle, and the fight was fixed. He had nothing left. Dad's first gift for me was the same thing that year as it was every year. New slippers. They were totally expected, but always appreciated. Every year, he pulled them out of the box, kicked off the pair he'd got the year before, and tried the new ones on while knocking his heels together and wiggling his toes around inside them. My old man did everything in slippers. Sure, he had shit style and never cared if anything he even wore even matched. But he knew how to be comfortable. "Okay, sweetheart, your turn," Dad always said as he dug through the mess of colorful paper, bows, and ribbons to find one for my mom. "This one's from me." Most years, my mom carefully tore through the wrapping and opened one of the things she'd asked for, something straight from her list. It could be anything, but let's just say a curling iron. And not just any curling iron, the exact, very specific curling iron that she'd wanted for months. The exact curling iron my brother was supposed to get and did get for her. Rich mumbled, "What the hell, Pops?" as he passed my dad on his way to root around under the tree for the exact same box in a slightly different wrapper to hand to my mom. "Okay, and this one's from me, I guess," Rich said while shooting my dad the same look he always did. Mom peeled back the paper, doing her best to look surprised, to reveal the exact same curling iron. She thanked Rich and Dad, then casually stacked them on top of each other beside her lazy boy. My dad laughed. "Well, now you have two. Nothing wrong with that. You can keep one in the basement." As if my mom had big dreams of doing her hair in the same bathroom where we kept the cat's litter box. This would go on and on, all morning long, gift after gift, every year. After all the organizing, all the work, the sublists from the main lists, the reassurances that we all knew what we were responsible for getting, my dad had taken my mom's entire list and bought it all, top to bottom. We always joked and goofed on Dad for his flakiness and inability to follow simple instructions. It took me forever to realize it wasn't that at all. This wasn't my dad not paying attention. This was him being unable to leave anything off my mom's list. He didn't have it in him. If my mom asked for it, my dad was going to get it for her, regardless of the rules. So she got everything. Twice. It was a predictable and hysterical mess. It was beautiful. But that Christmas, my dad's last, was the first year I can remember that not happening. No double gifts for my mom. My dad was too weak to shop, so my brother and I took care of it for him. Rich and I joked that we should buy mom two of something just to keep the tradition going, but I think that would have crushed them. When someone's dying slowly, piece by piece, every day, you do everything you can to never point out or remind them the things they've already lost. There was no way we were going to make my dad feel like he was no longer the guy who gave his wife everything she asked for. Dad still got his slippers that Christmas, but I had to put them on for him. I got a size smaller than I normally did, but he was still swimming in them. He'd lost so much weight that nothing fit properly. He looked like a little kid who got into his father's closet and just tried everything on. I rested his foot on my knee and helped him get the slippers on, but there was no heel kicking or toe wiggling this time. "They okay, Pops? Not too tight?" I asked. "Nah, they're perfect, son." It wasn't supposed to be like this. It wasn't supposed to happen this fast. As happy as I tried to look that morning, I was livid. We all were. My dad couldn't keep food down, and I'm not sure he ate one entire meal in the week leading up to Christmas Day. But he wasn't going to miss my mom's turkey dinner, and she wasn't about to let him down. My mom slayed dinner that night. It was a work of art. Absolute perfection. That dinner on Christmas Day was always my dad's favorite 90 minutes of the entire year, and this one was going to last a lifetime. Before we started, Pop asked if he could say grace. My parents weren't particularly religious people, but there's no shame in turning to God when you need a little extra help or have a prayer you hope has a chance of getting to someone who gives a shit. Dad talked for a few minutes, stopping and starting, wiping his tears with the sleeve of his sweater that was now two sizes too big for him. He reached out and held my brother's and my hands on either side of the table. All we could do was let him take his time. I don't remember how he started or what he asked for, but I remember how it ended. Thank you. Thank you for my life. I had a really good life. His head was down and his eyes were closed, but my pops wasn't praying. He wasn't thanking God. He was thanking us. Amen, he whispered to himself. That's it. One good day. When someone's dying, they have good days and bad days. Doctors ask that question all the time to people who are dying. Was today a good day or a bad day? Of course, what they mean is, how's your pain? But dying people actually do have good days. A good day can be nothing more than a few quick moments of normalcy, so it doesn't take much. Walking a few extra steps, laughing at an old joke that never gets old, or having the strength to hug you back with both arms. My dad's good days were built around exactly that. Anything that let him forget, even for a second, that he wasn't going to be our dad for very much longer. He wasn't in denial. He knew what was up. But on days when he needed a win, he usually found one. Early on in his treatment, maybe after his third surgery, I went to visit when they had him at a downtown hospital not far from where Rich and I were living. I walked in with a double banquet burger, fries, and gravy stuffed deep into the bottom of my bag so nobody would smell it as I made my way through the halls, avoiding every nurse I saw. Dad was propped up in bed, wearing the VR goggles I'd got him for Christmas, playing his Sony PlayStation. I wheeled his tray over. I tapped him on the leg and squeezed his foot to let him know I was there. "Hey, son," he said with that big smile I hadn't seen in forever. It had been months since we laughed together, and even longer since I'd seen him excited about something. "Guess what happened?" he whispered, really dragging out that last word, while slowly raising his hand as far as he could for an incoming high five. "I got a boner this morning." This was a good day. When someone you love is dying, you have good days and bad days too. For me, a good day was when I was able to get through without being reminded that my father was dying. At the beginning of all this, I really did try my best to do all the things and really be there for him. I made him kale soup because I read in the New York Times that dark greens were good for cancer patients. He hated it. I tried to get him up and walking around. He did his best. I sat with him during chemo a few times. On those days, when this all started, I was the good son. I didn't know what to do, so I did everything I thought I was supposed to do. In a lot of ways, I was acting the part of someone who was about to be half-orphaned, because that seemed easier than the alternative. This wasn't denial, it was just the truth. My dad had shit hair his whole life. A great mustache, but shitty hair. I don't think he ever had a full head of it. He wasn't a vain guy, so it never bothered him. Until the day his hair didn't do what it was supposed to do. I actually think, in a weird way, he was looking forward to losing it during chemo. But that didn't happen. They pumped his body so full of poison that he should have had nothing left. But his thin, wiry, three-toned, shitty hair refused to fall out. When he was in the middle of his second round of chemo and radiation, we drove out to see him and my mom and spend the night at their house. I brought my clippers. I sat my pops in a chair in their kitchen, wrapped one of my mom's good towels around his thin, bare shoulders, and took care of it for him. Row after row, I slowly shaved it off, gently wiping away what was left with my hand and kissing the top of his head as I went. I remember standing behind him because if I saw his face, I wouldn't have been able to get through it. I took off my shirt too, so it didn't get covered in clippings, and every time I reminded him to sit up as straight as he could, his back would touch my chest. He leaned into me, and I held him up with everything I had. When I was finished, I wrapped my arms around him from behind and tried not to hug him too tight. He was too tired to lift his arms to hug me back, but he managed to turn just enough that our foreheads touched. That was the best he could do and all I could hope for. That was the last time I remember hugging my dad while he was still alive enough for it to mean something. That was the night I said goodbye. He still had time left, but that was it for me, and I knew it. That's the last memory I have of me and my dad together while he was still him. Thanking me and telling me I was a good kid, and me saying, "Thanks, Pops," as I kissed the top of his head. Those are the last words I remember sharing with him. Not long after that, he went in for what would be his last surgery. This is the one that should have killed him. It was so incredibly invasive that he shouldn't have made it out alive. But he did. The plan was to go in heavy and rip out anything that didn't belong. His body was so riddled with tumors, the surgeons didn't know where to start or when to call it. Taylor was with me in the waiting room that night. We weren't officially back together, but she was right there with me through it all. Somehow, I managed to fall asleep, slumped over on a chair with my head on her lap, while my brother, his girlfriend Leanna, and our mom slept on the floor. I don't know what time the doctor walked in, but it was late, maybe almost morning. He flicked the light on before saying anything, and we all jumped awake, the same way you do during a lightning storm or a bad dream. "We did what we could," he explained. "We managed to get a lot of it out, but we couldn't stop the bleeding. He's still in there. We packed him with all the cloth, gauze, and sponges we had in the room to try to get it under control. That's all we can do right now." I put my head back down on Taylor's lap and waited it out. I was more numb than sad. The sadness I did have wasn't because my dad was in there dying. It was because he was in there dying alone. I'm not sure how much time that last surgery bought him, but he made it home for one last stretch. The good days from that point were hard to come by, no matter how much fight he had left in him. There was no optimism. There wasn't going to be a miracle. It was only a matter of time, and the best he could hope for would be a few minutes on the phone with his boys. That would have been a good day. He didn't want much. He just wanted a couple of minutes a day to forget all this and just be a dad. He needed to feel like he still mattered. And I took that away from him. In a lot of ways, I killed him off long before he died, in my mom's kitchen that night, when he was wrapped in a towel while I shaved his head. That's when I let him go. I did my best to start living my life without him, trying to get over his death while he was still alive. It was almost like some morbid obsession. I knew losing him would never get better, but I hoped it would get easier, and I wanted a head start to just fucking get on with it already. My dad went through his last months alive without me. He was dying, but I was the ghost. My mom called after Dad had fallen asleep one night to beg me to talk to him. "You know he sits by the phone all day hoping you'll call, right? Please call him. Just talk to him. Can I tell him you'll call?" "Of course," I replied. I promised I'd call after dinner the next night. I didn't. I never called. "When's the last time you talked to Pops?" my brother asked. He wasn't so much asking as he was confronting me. "I don't know. Not that long. The other day?" "It's been 3 weeks. You haven't talked to Dad in 3 weeks. I knew exactly how long it had been. The only times I did talk to Dad is when I walked into our living room while he and Rich were already on the phone. Rich would hand me the receiver. Even then, I couldn't get off quick enough. It was cruel. This was a man who'd given me his absolute best his entire life, and I couldn't give him 5 minutes on a Tuesday. I never learned how to grieve because I refused to acknowledge loss or the sadness of being hurt. My entire identity was built around coping mechanisms and distractions. It was easier to take responsibility and ownership over things that happened to me than it was to deal with or even admit to being hurt by someone else. I owned it all. Hiding scars from burning myself was easier than admitting what they were actually covering up. I was never sad, rarely angry, and I would never dream of taking anything out on another person. I was just stuck. I was stuck in that closet with that family friend when I was 9. I was stuck in every moment where I wished I could have said no. Every burn, every drink, every hotel room or backseat of a stranger's car. Every fight I knew I couldn't win. All the times I canceled plans at the last minute because I was too paralyzed with fear to leave the house. I was stuck in every situation I'd made myself a target because it was easier than trying to fit in. I hid my tics the same way I hid my wife leaving me. I let the things that hurt me continue to hurt me every day. Nobody teaches you how to grieve. It's not something they go over in school, and it's always the one topic you try your best to avoid with anyone who's already gone through it. We all grieve differently, and no matter how many people you surround yourself with, we all do it alone. Grief is natural. That's why most of us don't need medication or counseling and usually find or fight our way out of it. We're built for this. We don't know it, but we are. We're built to deal with incredible loss, pain, and sadness. I didn't understand that then. If you Google grief or how long it's supposed to last, what you'll find right there at the top are the famous five stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. What they don't tell you is these don't always happen in that order. It's not a map. I skipped the first four and forced my way to acceptance, and I was never going to look back. There was no anger and no room to bargain, but I deliberately and selfishly denied both myself and my dad the experience of losing each other. It wasn't meant to be cruel. I tried to convince myself that this was all coming from a good place, a place of love. I wanted to get on to grieving with love and not because of heartbreak and immeasurable sadness. I wanted this year to be over. I knew that if I did this, that eventually, when the time came, when that phone rang in the middle of the night to tell me it was time, I'd be better prepared. It was only much later I realized that none of what I did was done out of love. Guilt isn't one of the five stages of grief, but it should be. I was dealing with such incredible guilt. I blamed myself for all the things my dad wouldn't experience. When someone dies young, your heart breaks for the things they'll miss out on. I took all the blame for this. I blamed myself for not being good enough or fast enough for my pops to see me shine. His whole life, I was always on my way to becoming something, and he was never going to get to see his hard work fully pay off. I jumped into a marriage that was never going to work, and I robbed him of the chance to be the best grandfather any kid could ask for. He didn't get to stand beside me at my wedding, and as my marriage fell apart, I realized that any woman I met after Taylor would have no idea how incredible he was. And to my own kids, if I eventually had them, my dad would be nothing more than a story I told. For those last few months when I didn't call, it wasn't because of denial. It was guilt. I'd let him down, and I didn't know how to say sorry. Good night, Roadrunner. If I asked you to tell me the moment you grew up, could you answer? Like the moment your life changed forever, when you move forward from whatever kid innocence you may have had left. The moment where you separated from that other person forever. The old you would now be a memory, and nothing could ever be recaptured or repeated with any sort of honesty. A total reset. That's what happened to me the night I sat with my brother in a small beige office under fluorescent lights as a doctor slid a DNR form across the desk and asked if we wanted to sign it. A DNR is a fuck of a document. This is a do not resuscitate order, which instructs healthcare workers not to perform CPR if a patient's heart stops beating or they lose the ability to breathe on their own. This is also a way for them to inform you there's nothing more they can do. It's about compassion, not survival. It's a way of telling you the fight is over. Coming from a family of fighters, this was bloody hard to sign off on. It felt like a betrayal. My brother and I put our names on it, slid it back across that desk, and walked out carrying all the guilt and shame that comes with giving up on someone you love, in writing. My dad survived more than anyone should have to, but this was us committing to not fight for him. When we got to the hospital that night, that last night, he was already too far gone for anything to really matter. He wasn't conscious, and he couldn't talk or respond to anything we said. This was the end. These were the walls he was going to die behind, under shitty fluorescent lights, in a room with a window that didn't open. When it came to his family, my pops would have chewed through brick to make sure we were safe. But there we were, about to stand there and do nothing. We knew he had to do this alone. All dads, eventually, have to do this part alone. Doing nothing was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. When you sign a DNR, your family story changes, and everyone has to be on board. The story becomes less about motivation, less about the fight, and more about abandonment of all hope. I was still my dad's cheerleader and his champion, but instead of telling him to get up and walk, to eat something, to think positive and fight, I was leaning in whispering that it was okay to go. Instead of telling him how much I needed him, I was letting him know it was all right to say goodbye. I sat by his bed and held his hand. I repeated, "Don't worry, Pops, you did a good job, and we're all gonna be okay," over and over, hoping these words would make their way in, and I thanked them. This is when I first truly understood what I was actually losing. It was everything. I was losing everything. I never thought for a second about what the last words I'd say to my dad would be. This isn't something you rehearse, nor should you. All dads die. There's no other way to say it. That's not a reminder or a reality that I get any sort of joy from writing, but it's the truth. There's no lesson here, and you shouldn't for 1 minute waste your time wondering how you'd handle it. It's not something you can or should ever try to prepare for. Don't put it in your head, and don't run the scenarios. It won't help. When someone you love is dying, people try to relate to you while still offering whatever support they can. It's awkward, but sometimes beautiful too. They'll ask you how your loved one is doing without pressing too hard. They'll give you space, but still want the updates.